Hello everyone, my name is Jacob Minig. I am the host of the Behavioral Health Integration Podcast. Today we have a very special episode, LADCs and Private Practice. And my special guest is Robert Andrews Mendoza. Robert has his master's degree in mental health and addiction from Metropolitan State University. He has also started his LADC private practice. And with this great amount of experience and knowledge, we're all going to learn a lot. And I'm very excited to go on his journey with him.
Robert, thank you for being here, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm really glad to be here. This is kind of exciting.
It is. I know we're going to help a lot of people out, especially grad students right now. And that's something that I always preach, too. It's about helping us right now in the field, but more importantly, it's also helping the future generation of LADCs, mental health therapists, social workers, et cetera. So I feel like we're doing a great thing here.
Yeah, definitely.
But to start, man, I want to learn a little bit more about you. What originally got you passionate about this field and wanted to jump into like addiction counseling and so forth?
Such a good question. And I get it all the time from clients, actually. And I'd love to give you like a perfect package story, like, you know, well, I struggled with it too. And then I decided I wanted to help other people, but only part of that's true. In my early 20s, you know, I grew up probably with a pretty high ACE score myself. I grew up in a toxic environment. And ran away from home when I was like 17, lived in the streets for a minute in Minneapolis, and then went on from there. And that kind of always living in a reactive state and kind of always in a survival state, I made a lot of poor choices. And I was just kind of stuck in life. That eventually led me to drug use, methamphetamine use. In a really toxic and abusive relationship. And that then led to getting into trouble with the law and then going to federal prison for a year. When I got out, I'm just giving you the short version, but one of the guys that went to prison with me was also caught up in my legal case. We kind of became friends while we were in prison, and when we got out, we were bunking together in the halfway house that we had to live in for a while. And one day he said to me, you should come down to the community college with me, because he started school there at MCTC.
Nice.
And the first thing out of my mouth was like, I'm not smart enough for school, because I dropped out at 11th grade.
Okay.
And I was always like a CD student all the way through K-11.
Yep.
But I didn't know I had a co-occurring disorder. I didn't know I had a mental health disorder that was causing that. I was actually quite intelligent, but I didn't figure that out until later in life. So at first I said no, and then he kind of kept pushing. And then I thought, well, it can't hurt to go down and see what, you know, community college is all about. I have nothing else to do. Like, the only thing I'm doing with my life is sitting in the halfway house and then working at a hotel front desk for, you know, that's it. That was my life after prison. I went down and I just kind of got interested, and I looked at some of the course material, and I thought IT at first. And so I kind of took a couple classes in IT and networking, and I was fascinated by that, but it really didn't align with my, I'm a Pisces. So I'm really emotional.
Yeah.
It didn't really align with who I was, even though I still had an interest in it. Then I took a law enforcement class, and I thought that was really interesting. And then I just took some other general classes for kind of like AA classes, you know, working on that. And then one day, this is how it all happened. So I was trying to get my general classes done for mathematics, and I couldn't pass pre-algebra. I took it eight times. I could not get past pre-algebra. Man. And that was really hard on me, you know, because I thought, what is wrong? I could pass all these other classes, but math just eludes me. And so finally the financial aid office said, you're running out of money, man. You got like this much time left to complete a degree, and you're out of money. And I wasn't making enough money to pay for school. So knowing that, knowing I had a felony, and if I didn't do something different in life, like I was gonna continue kind of that life of poverty. I just said to them, well, it's this math class. I have to pass this math class in order to advance to do mm-hmm. anything else. And then they said to me, well, there is one program that you don't have to pass the math class. You can postpone it until your bachelor's and still graduate. And it was addiction counseling,
nice.
AS and addiction counseling with Bela and Jonathan at MCTC.
Okay.
And so I thought, oh man, you know, I don't want to be one of those people that are just doing this because I had a problem.
Yeah.
My thinking was so backwards, mm-hmm. right? But the truth was, that was exactly what I was destined to do. The universe knew it. I just wasn't aligning mm-hmm. with it yet. So these circumstances were happening that were kind of cornering me into it. And so I entered the program. And then I started taking more of interest in it, and then I graduated.
Was there a particular class that really sparked you early on? I'm just curious. Like psychopharm, intro to addiction counseling, anything like that?
That kind of stuff really didn't happen until bachelor's level at Metro. Okay. But yes, psychopharm with Theresa at Metro. Oh, yes. If I kept all her videos because on Cycle Farm, because she's quite smart, and mm-hmm. Yes, I got really excited about chemistry of the brain and addiction and mm-hmm. how that works, and I came to realize that there's a biological and chemical component to our behaviors, you know. So that was really exciting. And the other class that really stuck out to me was towards the end of my, I think it was a bachelor's program, when one of the clinic owners came in that worked in a more harm reduction, mm-hmm. at a harm reduction perspective. And she kind of went after me a little bit because I had said something about, working with clients that are high risk, and we were talking about how in her clinic, if clients didn't show up, they didn't get discharged, right? They just put the charts inactive if they disappeared for a while, and then they'd come back, and of course they'd try to find them, but if they couldn't, they would make the chart inactive, they wouldn't just discharge them. And that was mm-hmm. very different, a huge departure from what I experienced in the field. And I challenged that. I'm like, well, are you putting your license at risk? Like asking all these questions. And she really went after me. And I realized at that very moment that I had a really rigid perspective on how we could help people that are struggling with substances. Like, it really made me question all those times I discharged people just because they relapsed and they disappear for a week. And then they tried to come back, but we'd already discharged them. Mm-hmm. They disappeared from me. And it really made me think about, like, is abstinence really the only way to recovery? She really challenged that with me. And that was a fundamental in shifting my perspective and how I was going to start working from that point forward. Yeah, I left that class really, like, kind of hurt.
Was there really animosity? Me, but... Was it like healthy, friendly challenge, or was it like kind of bitter?
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm just super sensitive. But again, she got her point across. I mean, it really did fundamentally change how I, even the criteria I used to select, you know, who I'm going to work with. Yeah. Mm-hmm. In the master's program too, when I did that for mental health for co-occurring disorders, which I graduated from last year, really also opened up my perspective and really helped inform just how important it is that it's not just about arresting the said disease, but it's also about like evaluating what else is going on underneath that, right? And oftentimes, because substance use symptoms look like mental health symptoms, it takes time. You've got to invest time with your clients. You've got to walk with them for a while. on their mm-hmm. on their life journey in order to really start to pick out like what substance use and what is it, what other disorder is going on here, if any. So yeah, it was a really good educational experience. It was just tough because I worked full time. I went to school full time and I gave up any kind of personal life to finish that. Yeah.
So did you get your undergrad and master's both from Metro?
Mm-hmm.
Addiction counseling?
Yes. Okay. I went right into master's after my bachelor's. Started at MCTC, two-year degree, went to Metro bachelor's, and then right into the master's. I knew that if I didn't do that, I probably wouldn't go on to do the master's if I just didn't go right into it. Mm-hmm. And I'm so glad I did because it raised my awareness in so many areas.
Amen. Amen. Because a lot of people forget back in the day, you didn't need even a four-year degree to be addiction counselor.
Right. You didn't even need to do, there was one point you just need to have like experience with 12-step groups and you know all that. Mm-hmm. And I know somebody in the field still that's elderly that still works from very part-time just assessing, and she's one of those people and she has her license from that era. Yeah.
Wow. That's interesting. Yes.
Yeah.
So another part I want to ask you about is, so you're going through grad school, right? And were you ever worried about, okay, once I graduate, what avenue am I going to go into as a career? Where am I going to work? And do you feel like your program prepared you for that?
Well, I was always working since my two-year degree, starting with Pride Institute.
Okay.
I was always working in the field. I did my my internships at both inpatient, outpatient Pride, and then worked for Pride outpatient for a while before I left, and then went to a behavioral community health clinic in Brainerd. So I want to say like I was already kind of on my path when I was mm-hmm. going through those school programs, so I really wasn't sure where I was going to land. I just knew like I needed to focus completely on finishing mm-hmm. and then I figured, well, the universe will kind of lead the way. Mm-hmm. I had no idea how the universe was going to upend mm-hmm. me at the beginning of COVID.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, and that was divine intervention for sure. Like I don't think the school so much prepared me for my trajectory, but it gave me enough knowledge and information to kind of like have a map,
mm-hmm.
right, of the various tools and skills I needed, and then where to get those afterwards to sharpen them, and then you know, some ideas about maybe different types of careers in the field. But I was already working with clients, so I knew I'd be working with clients. I thought about maybe I would do maybe supervisor or maybe even, you know, program director for a 245G program at some point, but, we never got there because then COVID happened. And then, I lost my job at the clinic I was working at,
mm-hmm.
And that had more to do with a regulation related to LADCs and private practice that mm-hmm. I wasn't aware of at the time. And we can talk about that as part of this too, because it's important everybody knows that too,
mm-hmm.
which caused an abrupt departure at the beginning of COVID. And that led me into going into private practice. So I would say the universe directed my path more than I did consciously or the school did.
But you know, it's funny. I brought that up because I interact with a lot of nervous students because they're not sure yet, you know, because you sometimes get a lot of students who are actually going through the counseling grad program and who've mm-hmm. never worked at a treatment center or have done anything in the behavior health field.
Mm-hmm.
So they're like, oh man, you know, I'm going to do an internship. It's like, I don't know if I like working with kids, elderly people, substance users, or, you know what I mean? Different like mental health issues, and they don't know what direction to go in.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to say. I would say, you know, I had to work with different populations by working at different places to figure it out. I just had to have the experience. I don't think the school could have prepared me for that just because I'm a feeling oriented person. So to work with certain populations feels a certain way to me. To work with certain age groups feels a certain way to me. To, you know, it's all different. It's all, to me, it's all energy. So, and that's not true for everybody, but it's, how do you give guidance like that? I don't know, because I didn't know most of the time. I just had to go out there and try different things in the field and actually do it. And then I kind of figured it out. Like, I figured out pretty dang quick. I did not like working with adolescents. Like, I had a adverse reaction to it, to the point where it made me kind of sick in my stomach. Yeah. And then I knew, okay, that's off the list. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you just gotta go out there and try it. So when you're, if you haven't done your internships yet, I would highly suggest like picking your two internships, at least for the LADC program, with different groups that you think you might like, and test the waters.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, that's just great experience. And I just hate it when I see people like quit the field. And again, that's their choice, but it's like, well, you know, I tried working with adolescents and whatever, it's not working out, so I'm just done. It's like, well, no, you need to understand there's a lot of different avenues in this field that you can get into. You know, and again, that's on them if they don't want to pursue that though at the same time. If they don't, if they want to give up and do something else, that's on them. But all I could do is like support them. Be like, well, if you want to still try to stay in this field, look at other avenues. There's other things you can do.
For sure. And you could even go on to get your co-occurring master's, right? And then you're duly licensed, and then you're much, much, much more valuable in the market. You can, and I have a friend who doesn't believe in diagnosing. That was in my grad program. And so she is looking at doing more like educational lecturing. Right. Kind of more around that specifically, like how diagnosing can be harmful, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, that's a whole nother conversation, but there are lots of things you do, education, consulting, working for insurance companies. Oftentimes we don't think about that, but people that review claims or audits, do audits, right? They're often licensed alcohol and drug counselors or mental health counselors, right? So there are lots of avenues you can go with the degree. You just have to kind of get out there and feel them out a little bit and open your mind. It's not just about, you're not limited to just working at a treatment center or a treatment program. No, I wouldn't say that.
So now this gets me into one of my favorite parts of this segment is, let's say you do go to the treatment center, you go the 245G route, and I know you're very passionate about this as well, is, okay, dang, what are the highs and lows? What are the reasons why people get burnt out? And again, do what you want to do and open your private practice.
That's such a good question. Let me just start off. I'm going to embed this right away. Yep. In order to enroll as an LADC in private practice, you have to have 6,000 supervised hours in a licensed facility like a 245G program as an alcohol and drug counselor, specifically alcohol and drug counseling. So if you're just starting with your internships or you have been, you've done that and you're still working in the field and you don't have your 6,000 hours yet, do yourself a favor and collect those along the way. Maybe you'll never go into private practice, but in case you do, it's way easier if you have them already than having to go back like I had to do to Pride, for instance, years later and be at their mercy and ask them for those records. Fortunately, Todd over at Pride, he's great. He was very helpful and got me what I needed, but he could have made it difficult.
Yep. You know? And I got another question towards that. Now, when it comes to 6,000 hours, do they count your internship hours or does it have to be what they do?
No. Nope. Okay. Yep. Yep. Good. Yes. You got your 880 right there. Right. So, but it takes, you know, I think it took me about 4 years of experience to get that many hours working full time. So collect them along the way in case you decide to go down this route that we're about to kind of start talking more about, and then you have them. Yeah.
So moving forward now, when you're in that setting I mean, I feel passionate about this because I know me and you both have a lot of experience in this about the issues LADCs may face and go through. And it could be, God, low pay, caseload, management. I mean, there's a lot of things, and I'll let you reflect on that too in this moment. And
okay. And thank you for redirecting me because
I need
a lot of redirection.
No worries.
So, yeah, so I, like I said, I worked in a couple different, I worked in the Certified Community Behavioral Health Clinic, which was 245G. I worked at Pride, which is 245G, both inpatient, outpatient. And I worked in private practice for a little while before I started my own solo thing. And, you know, we all got to go through those big programs in order to get our hours, right, to do our internships and everything else. But I was absolutely, I was finding myself feeling burned out after, you know, 4 years of doing this. Our clients in particular are highly, well, they take a lot of energy, right? And they take a lot of our attention and focus. And 16 clients, which is the max caseload LADC should have, can have, I should say, not should have, can have, according to 245G, is still a lot, you know, and it's draining. And I was finding myself just exhausted at the end of every week, and the weekend wasn't enough to fully recharge. And so I really struggled with that caseload size, right? And the reason two programs do that is for the billing, right? They want to max out the numbers so they can max the highest amount of billing they can do that. That's one of the reasons, and it's a legitimate reason, but it also doesn't, just because it's legitimate, it doesn't mean it's necessarily like ethical or in the best interest of the staff or the clients. I also had some really nasty experiences with management. In some places, I won't specify where, but just really unethical behavior along the way. I ended up in some situations where the DHS was involved, and you know, I had to report some things anonymously because I was always at risk for retaliation. Just like really toxic environments, and that itself is draining, right? It takes all our energy just to show up for 16 clients a week. We don't also need to be battling bad management at the same time. Now, there's really great programs out there, too, that recognize these things, and they don't make their counselors take 16 clients. They do limit it to 10, 12, right? And they do have decent management, and they are focused on taking care of their employees. But you got to look for them. You got to really be... careful, you know, about even where you choose to do your internships, because that's, you're sitting in that energy all day long trying to help people. So it can be really hard. Do your research. I was really lucky. Like Pride was a really good experience for me. It had its challenges like any other business, but it was a really good experience for me. Todd was a great clinical director. Like anytime I had an issue, I could talk to him, and I didn't feel, I could talk to him and I felt safe talking to him.
We do a shout out for Todd. Thank you, Todd.
Yeah, Todd. Yeah. And he was really, and this is for like things you should be thinking about if you want to be a supervisor. And he was always kind of watching. So you know, I remember times where he'd just come and sit on the couch in my office and say, I can tell you're tense. You seem different this week. What's going on? Right. So to have a supervisor that can be that aware and observant and kind of tune into their clinicians to support them when they're not saying anything is also important. And then I had the complete opposite. I had some supervisors at a different place that were just, I had one at one point that wanted me to lie directly to, literally lie directly to the auditor that was there investigating. And I, that was a whole huge ethical battle that I struggled with. So I'm not trying to scare people. I'm just saying, just be mindful, like ask other people that have been there before. Like, what was your experience? What was management like? what are their employee benefits like? That can tell you a little bit about how they take care of their people.
You know? Robert, could you also say too, within yourself, know your value and know your worth as a human being and as a professional? Just know your value and what you deserve to be treated and
not now I do, but when I was battling and struggling through those places, it was hard to see. Lots of microaggression, right? So it was hard to feel valued or feel worthy when you felt like you were always doing something wrong, right? Even when you weren't. Mm-hmm. It's like a bad relationship, isn't it?
Yeah.
Or bad codependent relationship.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So pay attention, ask questions, do your research, be selective of where you choose. A lot of people end up staying at the places they internship at. So think about that. When I had the opportunity to go into private practice and choose how many clients I was going to work with a week instead of being committed to 16 and kind of choose my own schedule and all of that, like that turned it around. I still felt burnt out when I started in private practice for a couple months, but as I started to adjust to having a lower caseload, working more individually with people, not having to fight other staff members, right? Because it's just me.
Tell
that
me,
burnout went away.
What was your initial feeling within yourself when things started getting better? Was it like, oh my God, yes.
Mm-hmm. That I'd have the weekends off. I'd come back on Monday and I'd be ready to start again. I wasn't getting that anymore at the other programs. At the other programs, Monday would come around and I'd be like, I still need a couple more days to recharge.
Yes.
And I also, like, Friday would happen, the weekend would happen, and in private practice, I realized early on, I'm not worried about anything over the weekend. Like, I'm not worried about the politics going on at the office or what could happen over the weekend, you know, because there's nobody to answer to anymore but myself. So little things like that I took note of.
Robert, I got another kind of side question to piggyback from what we talked about before. Back when you were an addiction counselor, would you ever see, let's say, another staff member or an LDC really stressed out and it's hard to, you know what I mean? They try to hide it, but do you console them? But at the same time, you don't want to be their therapist, right? So you have to have some boundaries, but you still care about them, right? Have you ever done that and thought about that in a certain way?
Colleagues?
Yeah. You worry about them, you know?
I think in the toxic environments I worked at, we openly talked about those things with each other. Okay. We all were feeling it. We're all feeling stressed all the time. We were all feeling our nervous systems were activated all the time, chronically, you know? And so we recognized that much. We knew we were in a bad environment. So there was camaraderie that way. But no, we never really tried to therapize each other. We just like soldier up, you know? Mm-hmm. It's a means to an end for most of us. We were all on a certain path and most of us weren't going to stay there forever. And that's another thing too. Like if a program can't keep people and they keep turning over staff all the time, that's a sign too, right? That something isn't quite right that you should take note of. How can you do appropriate self-care and find a work-life balance if your nervous system is constantly stressed? You can't.
Absolutely.
You just can't.
Yeah. That's why, again, I really love this episode because we're letting LADCs know, like, there is a great future for you if you want to take it. But Robert, I also mentioned to you too, once we start getting into more private practice, that it may not be for everyone, right?
Right. Well, first, you know, like I said, you have to have the 6,000 hours, but it may not. And let me just say this for ADCTs. So people that ADCT is the 2-year degree for chemical dependency, where you work under a supervisor until you get your bachelor's degree. Those hours while you're as an ADCT, those count towards your 6,000 hours also. and your internship hours. So I just wanted to clarify that in case anybody is listening with ADCT, like I went that path. Okay, ask me the question again.
Yeah, so we can actually start. I know, and to all my listeners, Robert did a great Facebook Live on this stuff as well. We're kind of going to do a little review of that too. So Robert, the floor is yours if you want to kind of get into the actual start and how to do this. I mean, as much as you want, because again, you've already kind of done this before, but I knew there were also questions that were not answered on that live, right? That you could possibly get into as well. So,
okay, let's talk about professional boundaries first. If you're going to go into private practice, you have to be able to self-regulate well with boundaries. You know, part of the requirement is that you're also listed as a LADC supervisor. So you have to complete that application component with the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy. So, and it makes sense, right? If you're going to be out there solo, you should know how to be a LADC supervisor too. Because in 245G programs, normally, you know, if there's an issue, you go to your supervisor, they help guide you. So you have to be able to kind of self-guide, self-govern, and self-regulate, especially professional boundaries with clients, right? Super important. So if you struggle with boundaries with clients, then you're not ready for this. I would suggest not even attempting it until you figure out how to do that, right?
Could you elaborate on some examples of how maybe clients might try to cross those boundaries and how you need to handle that? Mm-hmm.
I'll give you a worst case scenario. I had to report someone to the board, I'm not going to say when, but it was a situation where I had a client who reported to me that their LADC was offering work on her home to this client's partner. So there were instances where my client and my client's partner were out at this LADC's home doing work. Can't do that.
No way, no people.
Right? That's an extreme example. A more subtle example would be just not being able to manage transference and countertransference well, right? I'll give you a recent example. I had a client say to me recently, well, next time I'm down in Maple Grove, maybe we can go out for coffee. No, we can't. Mm-hmm. Right? And then you have to, in a professional way, explain boundaries and why they're important and mm-hmm. how it keeps the therapeutic relationship safe and keeps energy between us clear, right? So you have to be able to manage that.
I remember this one time when I first started. They gave me a work cell phone, which is cool. And obviously the clients know your work cell number and everything. Yes. But this random client out of nowhere just texted, hey, to me. And I didn't respond back because I got the feeling like he just wanted to hang out as a friend. It didn't seem like a clinical question or, you know, a group question. It was just like, hey, and that was it. So I'm like, again, I could be overthinking this, but it's like, okay, what kind of dialogue is he trying to start right now?
Yeah, and it wasn't a client at the time?
It was a client, but he just said, hey. Yeah. He didn't express more what he wanted to talk to me about. It was just, hey. So, and again, I was a new counselor, so I didn't know how to perceive that.
Yeah. So those are the kinds of things that you need a supervisor for, right? Mm-hmm. And those kinds of things to be unsure about how to handle, that's normal when you're early and you're in the field and you don't know. That's why you have a supervisor. Mm-hmm. Because those things happen. And so you can go to your supervisor and say, hey, this client just did this. What do I do? Like, what is appropriate? What isn't? That's how you learn. And that is why they want you to have 6,000 hours supervised experience. Because our clients, especially our clients, oftentimes will have serious issues with boundaries. They haven't learned them. And part of our job sometimes is to teach healthy boundaries, and that includes role modeling them. Mm-hmm. You know, so how you respond to that is an opportunity to teach. Absolutely. And you don't want to miss the mark.
Yeah. And I think counselors maybe have it harder now than past due to social media. dating sites, Facebook, where your clients can look you up. I mean, so many more scenarios that we need to be aware of now.
Yeah, you really do need to. So you should, even in private practice, you should have a social media policy. Mm-hmm. And you should really be mindful about how open you want that access to be to your stuff online. So like my Facebook, if I don't, you can't connect with me without being approved by me, right? And if a client sends me a request, I will not accept it, but I will bring it up in the next session and remind them of my policy, why I have it, why it's important to our work together. And I don't usually get pushback after that. Like they get it, you know. Again, opportunity to teach boundaries, even in the digital space.
Yeah, that's so cool that you said that, because I'm kind of a nerd when it comes to podcasts and relationship podcasts. There's this therapist episode where this female therapist was on a dating site and the male client, you know, swipe right, let's say, on her. So she had to handle it. So she did exactly what you said to do. Like the next session, she talked about it. She didn't just hide it or ignore it. She just brought it up and said, hey, you know, it's not appropriate that we do stuff like that, etc. And so that's cool that you said that.
Yeah, and if you're duly licensed and you have a mental health background, you might take that further and, you know, sit with the client and wonder out of curiosity, like, what was that like for you? And then what this maybe even go as far as what was it like for me, if it's appropriate, right? Mm-hmm. And that's a moment, too, to kind of do some reality testing and, you know, be practice authenticity and communicating. But if you have the mental health background to know how to navigate that. But for sure, set the boundary. Yeah, you don't want that to happen. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a board complaint waiting to happen if you don't handle that right. Right.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Supervision. That's why supervision is so important. And if you're in private practice and those things come up and you still struggle with it, that's why it's also good to be connected to others who have either as much experience in the field that can kind of remind you mm-hmm. this is how we handle it. And or have handled themselves, or have an ethics person that you can consult with on demand. I have one from the university, a professor, right? So when things get really sticky with ethics, I email her. I'm like, I need to book an hour consult. Mm-hmm. I'm willing to pay for that just to get my answer, right? And that is extremely helpful.
Absolutely. No, that's a lot of great stuff, you know. You know, when you're starting your business, you need to be aware of all those different aspects that can have a huge effect on your private practice.
Yeah, I'm always thinking about what could be a licensing issue. So what could be a board complaint? Or what could be a problem with insurance audits, right? Those are the two things always in my mind. But as in a 245G program, I'd be thinking about what could be a board complaint and what could be a DHS yes. audit issue, right? But you're not going to worry so much about audits when you're in 245G because it's not going to come back directly on you. It's going to come back on the program. In private practice, it'll come back on you.
Mm-hmm.
So always thinking about those things.
Okay, nice.
Boundaries, so important. Emotional boundaries, spiritual boundaries, mental mm-hmm. boundaries, physical boundaries. Yeah.
Always doing your work. That's great.
Always.
Now, how much did you want to get into the actual documentation to start an LED practice? Or do you want to get more broader into different stuff?
Well, you know, first of all, the how to enroll as a licensed professional in private practice to provide SUD services is on the DHS website. You just Google that, you'll find it.
And to my listeners, I will put that link down as well on my show notes.
It's about halfway down the page. And it the heading is for individuals providing SUD services in private practice. So like I said, from the very beginning, you need to have 6,000 hours of documented experience. Some of you may struggle with, well, how do I have it, but I haven't documented it along the way. How do I get proof now? I was in that position. So with Pride, Todd had HR print my payroll hours, and DHS accepted that. And then at the behavioral health clinic I was at, I had HR write me a letter saying that these are, you know, the hours I worked as an LADC from these days to these dates. And that was sufficient for enrollment, provider enrollment. So that you need to have. From there also, you know, you need to go through the process of getting approved by the Board of Behavioral Health to be a LADC supervisor. It's not hard. It's an application, it's a small fee, and then you have to complete so many supervision kind of education, like continuing education stuff, which is outlined on the Board of Behavioral Health website where there's LADC supervisor application. I did all my educational components online. I think I found most of them for free. If you're part of NADAC, you can probably find them all on the NADAC website for free. Just make sure they're ones that the board counts and that they align with the application. You can pay for them too, but they tend not to be very expensive. So you got to complete that part. Once you have those pieces, then you can start to fill out the actual main application, right? You do have to have your bachelor's degree, right? Now this brings up the question I never thought about before. What about people like my friend who's elderly, who doesn't have a degree and has their LADC license? I don't know.
Hopefully grandfather
next time. Him. Yeah, I don't know. Next time I talk to DHS, I will ask that question and I'll post it. So let me just, so LADCs, Minnesota LADCs and Solo Private Practice is the Facebook group that I started at the beginning of all this. That's usually where I post things as I learn them. That's a good thing to be connected to if you're thinking about going in this direction or you are in this direction. It's also a good resource for things like, okay, I'm billing something and this is happening, and most likely somebody will know or be able to guide you, right? So 6,000 hours supervisor approval, then you can fill out the application. You do have to have insurance, which we talked about the other day. It can be kind of nuanced. So the minimum requirements are listed on the DHS site, but it doesn't list some of the requirements UCARE has.
There we go.
Do this. So I've enrolled with all the PMAPs. All the different insurance PMAPs, UCARE, Hennepin Health, all of them. UCARE requires some additional components on your liability insurance, like commercial general liability, fire, water, legal liability, business personal, or no, wait, not business personal, license board defense, I'm not sure about, but it's those, the general liability and the fire, water liability that were things that the DHS application didn't say you had to have. And none of the other insurance companies required it. So if you go by the UCARE requirements, that'll cover everything when you buy that policy. I just looked at it so I could tell you how much it was for last year. It was $400 through CPH where I bought it. But again, if you're part of NADAC, you'll probably be able to get a better rate. That information is posted in the Facebook group too, what those limits are.
$400 so get for 1 year.
Insurance.
Oh, that's good.
You got to have that with the application, and I'll cover you for a year. And I like CPH because it's portable insurance; it's not location specific. And I just like that flexibility. But I'm sure you could find something through NADAC that has that too. So that needs to be done, and then it's just a matter of filling out the forms in order that are listed on the DHS website with the application. There's a provider agreement you need to fill out, behavioral health fund agreement you need to fill out. And for those of you that don't know what the behavioral health fund is, because it's still fairly new, it's great. It's a separate fund set aside. It's not MA. Let me clarify the difference right now. Because, you know, we can bill MA if a client has MA, but they don't have a PMAP yet. So usually when somebody applies for like a public health plan through the county, they'll get MA right away, like immediately. But there's within the first month or two, they're supposed to enroll in a PMAP. So between that time, you'd bill MA for said services. So there's a separate fund, behavioral health fund, set aside for people that meet the income limits and either don't have insurance, maybe they're unemployed for the moment, or maybe they have insurance, but it doesn't cover said services and they still meet the income criteria. So for instance, I had a client start with me that was laid off from work because of, well, it doesn't matter, but she was laid off for work for a while. So her income dropped to zero for the moment. And her insurance didn't cover said services. So the behavioral health fund picked up the cost for a while. And then when she went back to work with her insurance she did have, it wasn't in network with me. So they weren't covering any said services. So the behavioral health fund still picked up the bill. The behavioral health fund is administered through the MA system, even though it's a separate fund. So we still bill through the MA system. And that's important to note. So that's what the behavioral health fund assurance statement is about. Substance use provider assurance statement. And then that's it with the application. The other thing I want to just deviate and say that I really want this to come to, for everybody to hear this, because it's super important. When the laws passed to go into this field for the first time, I went to a private clinic, a mental health private clinic. It was a group, right? And there was one other LADC also that worked within that group. And when this started, we both enrolled as LADCs in private practice with that group. We were the only two LADCs there at that clinic. Everybody else is mental health. Now, bear in mind, at the time, there wasn't a lot of guidance on the website. DHS was still trying to figure it out. We were one of the first people to enroll. We didn't understand the rules very well yet. We weren't be able to get clear guidance. So, but anyways, we were able to enroll that way. And then we were just added to the clinic's insurance group contract and no problem, right? Until one day DHS came knocking on the door. And it was a technicality that put us on their radar. And I didn't meet with them, but the office manager and then the other LADC did, because I was in Mexico at the time on vacation.
It's so not your fault, though. Not your fault.
And they said that, and this, you can find this on the Substance Use Disorder Provider Assurance Statement for Professionals on the DHS website. There is a line on there now, wasn't at the time, but there's a line on there now that says that you have to initial, so you're agreeing to it, but it says, I attest that I will not affiliate, keyword is affiliate, I will not affiliate with other licensed or unlicensed professionals to provide alcohol and drug counseling services per Minnesota Statutes 245G.01 Subdivision 17. Affiliation does not include conferring with another professional or making a client referral. So what does that mean, right? Because that wasn't clear either at first. Basically, what it meant for me at the time was I could not work on a group contract with other professionals providing substance use disorder services. So that day I lost my job while I was in Mexico. That's what I meant earlier about the universe intervening, right? I departed immediately because I didn't want to have anything to do with in compliance with the rules.
But it's funny because LPCCs are licensed providers in the mental health field, can do that, right? Mm.
That's a gray area. Okay. So technically, a licensed mental health provider, you know, if they're competent, they could address substance use from the framework of mental health. Like, right, mm-hmm. There has to be a mental health disorder driving the substance use. And then you have to assess and treatment plan that way. So they could treat it that way, but, or they could have additional training, which qualifies them to treat it. But for the most part, I think what this is saying, my perspective is you cannot have two people under the same roof that treat substance use disorder. So I would just stay away from any. The spirit of the law was entitled, was created to, for people that are going to be in solo private practice. And that's why I named my Facebook group Solo Private Practice, right? So if you're on a group, in a group, you're still in a gray area, right? Even with other mental health providers, if they're providing services to clients. So I would stay away from it. This place I was working at was not a 245G licensed facility. So it's not like I could have just stayed and just worked under the 245G license. And turns out leaving that time was the best thing because the clinic ended up closing that later that year. And yeah. So stay away from attaching yourself with any groups. And if you are already and you're in that position, because I am aware there are certain clinics and providers that are doing that right now, you are not in compliance with the rules. So when in doubt, you can contact the Attorney General's office at the state. I think Christy was the one that they talked to last time.
Okay.
Or Richard Moldenhauer, DHS, is pretty well-versed. He, I think he had something to do with writing the law. So, and, you know, I usually ping him on Facebook and get answers to things. So he'd be a good person to talk to, too. Or you can consult a healthcare attorney if you don't want to go, you know, to the government. So there's guidance. You just have to ask. And every situation is different and nuanced. So ask for guidance first. Now that that language is on that form, if you initial that form and you're really not doing that, you can get into a lot of trouble.
Yep.
You know? Yeah. Okay. Well, let me just answer some things that did come up from people that I remember.
Mm-hmm.
Telehealth.
Yes.
So prior to the COVID crisis, providing substance use group via telehealth wasn't a thing you could do, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those rules have changed with the Minnesota legislature. There's some nuances to that, but the 2021 Behavioral Health Special Session Legislative Summary, which if you just Google that, you should be able to pull it up from DHS, outlines the new changes for telehealth. So now we can provide billable said services via telehealth, whether it be as private practice LADCs, whether it be treatment coordination, individuals, group, or comprehensive assessments. There are some important nuances. So, you know, if you're thinking about going into this and you're thinking about, well, I need to rent a space, right? I need to rent an office. That can be quite expensive, especially when you are waiting to be contracts to be created.
Yes.
And credentialing to go through. MA can take a month or two to get approved. And then once that's approved, then you can apply for the PMAPs, right? You have to wait for that first. So at the time, I didn't have any money. I was operating on savings when I lost my job. And so I decided to make my home office my business office. And I have an office here in my home for that specifically. But I'm also in a apartment that's secured. So, you know, at first I was nervous about it, but it's been fine. I just don't put my unit number on anything. So telehealth, like, it's important that you have a professional environment, right? So what shows up on your screen, the client sees, it should still be professional. The software you use, you need to have a business associated agreement to be in compliance with HIPAA. So Zoom has that, right? Google, the professional Google workplace has it also, okay. But you have to turn it on in the settings. It's not by default. And in Zoom, when you sign up for Zoom, it gives you that, there's a checkbox before you finish the transaction to set up. You have to activate that. So, you know, even the software you use to do telehealth is important. Some EHRs have it built in. Simple Practice, which I've been using, has it built in, but I'm migrating away from that, and that's a different conversation. So professional environment, logs. So when insurance comes in and audits your claims and records, and they will do that, probably not until after like the first year, but they will do it. They may ask for the logs from Zoom or Google or whatever to verify that the timestamps there match what's in your progress note, right? Or your appointment time in the EHR. So keep those, you know, make sure that you're marking the right place of service. Telehealth is 02 right now, although 10 is being added later. And you should be good to go, but it's super important that you're coding that right for billing too.
That's very interesting. And I can imagine, yes, you getting in big trouble saying, well, I met with this client 2 hours this week, and then they check the Zoom and there's no like conference or nothing that you met with them. Yep. And that's fraud in a sense, right?
Only if there's intent to defraud. So if it's like just like an anomaly, like it happens here or there, and there's no like consistent pattern, they're probably not going to see that as fraud. And they're probably going to see that more as, okay, you just missed something, right? You put the wrong place of service on the appointment window or something, right? Mm-hmm. And they may or may not claw back that claim. That'll be their recourse. But if there's a consistent pattern of it, and it looks like intent, yes, you can be charged with fraud. So don't do it, especially the public health plans. You do not want to mess with them. They got the most legal power behind them. So yes, make sure that the EHR, the time appointment window matches what how long you actually met with them, that matches the Zoom logs or whatever. Or if it's built into the EHR probably tracks it for you. So do not bill what's not true. I mean, that's always been true. Do not bill what's not true. Always make sure it's true. And you're marking it as telehealth. And then I've just been I have a drop-down and box in all my progress notes, everything that says telehealth, you know, just in case telehealth there due to COVID-19. And then the originating source, which would be where the client is. Because remember, we're only licensed in the state of Minnesota. So if a client is not in the state, you cannot provide services to them. If they're on vacation in another state, you cannot technically provide services to them because that would be governed by that state's board, right? You wouldn't be licensed in that state. Could you bill and the claim pay? Well, yeah, because their insurance policy is probably here in Minnesota, but you shouldn't do it because it's you're not licensed in that state. Could you get licensed in another state? Sure. Yeah, probably, but you have to go through that board process and it's different for every state. So maybe that's important to you. Maybe you work on the Minnesota-Wisconsin border and some of your clients are from Wisconsin, then you'll probably want to enroll with the board in Wisconsin so you can also provide services, telehealth to them also. So wherever they are at the moment of the session has to be within the state unless you're licensed in those other states. Make sense? Mm-hmm. You as a provider could be anywhere. I can be in Mexico. Doesn't matter.
Yep. And so I have another question regarding billing. So you bill, let's say, 1 to 135. Technically, that rounds up, right? And that's pretty much one session, if that makes sense. It's counted as one unit, right? There's like a cutoff line. Maybe, I guess, more in the 45 minute. So it's like you do like 40 to 45 minutes, let's say, but I think like when you click tab and time over, they're just going to bill it as one session or one unit, correct?
Right. So it's usually more than half the time. So,
you're really not doing an hour session. You're just doing like 35 minutes maybe or whatever.
Could be. My sessions tend to go an hour because clients love it.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that you can do as a private practice clinician that maybe you couldn't do in a 245G program. I remember always being restricted to 30 minutes. But technically, to bill an hour of individual H2035, it needs to be 31 minutes or more. Same with group. You know, one unit, 35 minutes, 31 minutes or more. Peer recovery support is billed in 15-minute increments for a unit. Or not peer recovery, I'm sorry, treatment coordination, 15-minute increments. And then, of course, your assessment's going to be more than an hour, maybe an hour and a half, or but you'd bill it as a unit. If you're billing, if you're duly licensed and you're a mental health clinician and you're providing both services, you might instead choose to bill mental health instead because it might be a better rate. But that's a different conversation. For just us LADCs, yeah, one unit, usually equal, whatever the increment is. So for group and individual, it's hourly. For comp, it's an hour at least. Treatment coordination is 15-minute increments as a unit. Yeah. Yes. And you don't want to, I always go back and check the logs after group because I can see who was logged in, how long. I can't keep track of everybody the whole time. I try to, but if they logged in and out, like all those things, right? And then I edit the time right away on the appointment window after the group session. So it's accurate. Yep. Absolutely. And so the Behavioral Health Fund service rate grid with dollar amounts, document PDF, you can Google it and find it. We can post it too. Those are the minimum rates that the Medicaid program, PMAPs pay, MA pays, right? So if you're thinking about, do I want to do this and go into this? That's how I figured it out. Like, what's the math? I sat down with the calculator and I figured out, okay, well, if I did two groups and I had 10 clients a week for, you know, I'm seeing them once for individual, two times for group, 3 hours for group. I started doing the math and figuring out like where that put me on the income bracket. And that really motivated me to keep going in this direction.
And to all my listeners right now, yes, that is a huge pro right there. And it's not that we're money greedy. No, there's no shame that we want to take care of our clients, number one, but we have every right to have a good salary and good benefits and to live a good life. You know, and that's my two cents on that. So,
yeah, absolutely. You know, if you work hard, so I was working like a dog in these programs.
Yep.
Right. I mean, I was there mm-hmm. late nights during the week and even Friday night, I was late finishing up WPNs. Right. And I didn't get anything more than my hourly rate. No matter how hard I worked. Being in private practice, like when I bill that claim out, I know I'm getting that full claim back.
Yeah.
I'm not getting half or an hourly salary, right? I'm getting the full contracted amount, minimally what the rate state rates are, mm-hmm. can't be any lower than that. My rates are a little bit higher than the state rates because of my experience and whatever, but like by a dollar or two, it's not much. And if you're duly licensed, this is what I will say to you. When you're going to seek your insurance contracts, really, really argue for the highest rates possible because being duly licensed is extremely valuable to insurance companies. And they know that. They know it's important. Mm-hmm. They know there's a lack of service providers. And they will be more willing and open to hearing your argument than somebody, let's say, with just a mental health degree or just an LADC degree. So don't just take the first offer necessarily, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's been an interesting journey because I was always told, even in grad school, the Twin Cities market is a closed market.
Yeah.
So you can't really get insurance contracts here. And so initially what I was thinking, because I'd worked in rural Minnesota, is, well, there's a law that says if you start your own clinic in rural Minnesota, insurance companies are compelled to give you a contract by Minnesota law. I'm not sure what law that is. I'd have to look it up. And I knew that from other agencies out there that I worked with. So I thought, well, I'm just going to open up my home base in rural Minnesota, but I'm going to telecommute from the city. And like that, I was thinking about all these ways I could do this. Because once you have the insurance contract, you're good. Right?
Mm-hmm.
You can move that around. But when, again, circling back to not having any money, starting all this from Maple Grove in my apartment, I was pleasantly surprised to find out like every PMAP plan I applied for, it was approved. That's partially because, well, I'm not sure if it's because I'm in Hennepin County or if it's because there's such a problem right now with opioids. There's just DHS is requiring it because they want, you know, this new law. There's a purpose for it, right? So I've been able to get every single one. And once you have those LEDC contracts, where, you know, other people trying to get, I know people that have been, that are PhDs, PsyDs, that have been trying to get insurance contracts in the Twin Cities market for years and can't, you know. Once you have those contracts, then if you're duly licensed or if you're on the mental health track or you're thinking about the mental health track, you already have the contract. So what happens once you're licensed is you just go back to the insurance company and say, now I'm duly licensed, I can provide mental health services too. And they'll say, okay, we're just going to add those codes to your contract, and they expand your contract, right? So now you're able to bill both SUDS and mental health codes if you're duly licensed in private practice. And that also can influence how you're thinking about how to provide services and how that might impact dollar, right? What services you're going to be billing for, and how that might work out. Don't forget though, still have to pay taxes. Yep. You know, when you get full and you start seeing the money, it can be really tempting to forget about taxes, but mm-hmm. don't. There's a provider payroll tax in particular, 1.8% of all services claims, you know, services you provide that you have to pay quarterly to the Department of Revenue. That's separate mm-hmm. from, you know, your other taxes. So get a tax accountant, help, let them help you. Yeah. So there's a lot of opportunity for this, because I know two other people doing this right now. I want people that are doing this or are going to move in that direction to really plug into the Facebook group and stay connected, because I get lots and lots of clients that get referred to me because the referent wants a private practice LEDC, but they don't meet my criteria for whatever reason, right? And so if I know who you are and you're out there doing this stuff and I know what your criteria is or when you have openings, I'm quick to push, you know, tell that referent, call this person or call that person. They're doing this, they're doing that. There are plenty of clients. There's no reason why you wouldn't be full all the time. You're the one that's going to have to decide how many clients do you want to manage mm-hmm. in a week.
You know, Robert, that's a great question, because I know when we talked earlier, some counselors are maybe okay with 14, 15, but there mm-hmm. may be counselors sure. like me who aren't necessarily the best at, let's say, time management or paperwork, which again, I am working on, but mm-hmm. we may feel more comfortable with 8, 9, you know, sure. that's when we do. Yeah. There's no shame in that.
Nope. So what I would say to you is think about how can I, so maybe you struggle with keeping it all straight when you have too many clients, right? Mm-hmm. So how can I just, align my services with the higher need, right? So ASAM 2.1 would be like high intensity, which would be more than 9 service hours a week with, you know, multiple stuff going on, right? So maybe instead of doing two groups a week, I'm going to do 3 groups a week. I'm not adding any more clients. I'm just adding how much I'm billing, right? If the client meets criteria for that need, right? So aligning yourself with ASAM. Versus having 2 groups and then having to take on more clients to bring your income up a little bit more, right? So there are ways around that. And also your EHR can help you if you pick the right one. If you're not good with 245G clinical documentation and you struggle with like how to even write it, mm-hmm. like the verbiage, because some of us are really great clinicians, but we suck at documentation. True. Then I would highly suggest looking at IconNotes. IconNotes pretty much writes your notes for you.
IconNotes,
right. Yeah, and Pride had it for a while. I mean, it was designed for behavioral health clinicians, and they have the 245G kind of format already, the dimensions already built in. And literally, it can write, it's just all push button. You just push buttons, and then it writes the sentences for you. Now you got to be kind of careful with that because it still needs to be person-centered. So you're going to quote things here or there, but if clinical documentation is your issue, Iconos is reasonable in price, and it will help you a great deal with that. ProSentiv, and in Iconos, the forms flow, right? So weekly progress notes will flow. ProSentiv would be the next one. That those 245G documents they already have, and those forms flow too. Simple practice forms do not flow. They do not have 245G documents. And even if you create them, which you can, the documents don't flow. So for instance, weekly progress notes, I have to do on an Adobe document, copy it every week, and then upload it to the chart. It's like 8 extra hours of clinical writing a week. Not worth it for me. So I'm transitioning to a different EHR. So those are my suggestions. And I have looked at everyone I thought might work with SUDS. I spent months investigating EHRs, and it comes down to Iconos, ProSentiv, and then I'm transitioning to NSYNC, but NSYNC is expensive. It's $400 a month just for one provider. ProSentiv is going to be closer to like $150, $160 a month. Okay. And then Iconos is going to be closer, I think, to like $100 a month, plus whatever they charge you to process a claim. It's usually like 1% or 2%. Okay. So yeah, be serious about how you're going to lay that foundation. What's going to be your EHR? Because that's where all your notes are kept, you know. And what's going to work best for you? Do you need one that has telehealth built in?
Yeah.
I would not suggest ever meeting with clients in your home. Just don't do it. It's not a good idea. If you're going to start at home, start telehealth only. And lots of insurance contracts will have issues with that. It'll stipulate you can't do that, right? But not all of them. Like Health Partners, for instance, it's very clear in their contract that you cannot see clients in your home. Okay. Just don't do it. That's a boundary thing again, right? It's a bad practice. Is it possible? Probably, because mental health clinicians do it sometimes. And could you make it appropriate? I guess if you have the right setup and you're really, really good at boundaries. But you know, I wouldn't do it. I just wouldn't do it. Nope. Not in our field. Not. It would be a different conversation if you had a lot of experience as a mental health clinician, because then we could talk about a lot of the things that might happen in a different way. But as an LADC, we're limited in our knowledge base if we don't have that mental health piece.
Yeah.
And how do we handle transference, counter transference, is going to be limited compared to somebody who's had more education, right?
Yep.
Here now I'm promoting going on to get your mental health stuff.
So
really think that out carefully. Do not show up on a screen as a clinician with, you know, and it looks like you're in your basement and it's a mess in the background, and don't do that.
So, and that kind of goes into just the time management, and all the clinicians who are like me, and you may be hearing all this stuff and you're super excited and you want to jump into it. No, just slow down, get your ducks in a row. That's so important.
I just jumped into it because I'm impulsive. And I was under pressure. Like I lost my job, you know, blah, 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 blah. So there are some things like I'm like now like catching up on that I should have done in the beginning, like the policies and procedures manual. You got to have one of those, physical copy for insurance audits. And then forms, there needs to be a form section with all your forms in there too, printed out, right? Needs to be readily available. You should have an index in front. Amanda Richards has a really great one, an index that you can probably get from her. You know, I wouldn't ask her. She gave mine as part of a consultation that I paid for, so I wouldn't expect her to give it free. Maybe she will, but you know, I offer something, $10, whatever, you know, is worthy, or ask her that, you know. I haven't created one yet. I suppose I could. I do some consulting for a fee with LADC starting in the field or in the field, and then they run into a roadblock and they can't get any help. They've been trying to get help with DHS, license, all these things, and they're just not getting anywhere. So you could always reach out to me that way too. I do charge like anywhere from 50 to 150 an hour. It just depends on what you can afford. For example, like I have one LADC in private practice that sometimes is particularly with MA. This last time was behavioral health fund. she just couldn't figure out how to get the claims to go through for somebody. It just, everything she did wasn't working. And every attempt she made to provide her enrollment wasn't helpful. You're going to run into that, right? And in those moments, you need somebody who has been in that situation and figured it out already. So for me, it was easy. I was able to look at it, figure out, okay, well, actually the problem was had to do with the Dane's record, the treatment authorization, mm-hmm. and a particular CPT code, right? For me, I saw it right away. But for her, she had been working on it for a month and she had like thousands and thousands of dollars just coming back, you know, declined from Blue Cross Blue Shield constantly, and she was frustrated. So, you know, in an hour, not even an hour, it took us 10 minutes. We fixed it, and the next day everything went through. So things like that, when you're really feeling the pressure and you feel like you're not getting any help, because I'm telling you, DHS is going to be limited in how they can help sometimes. Yeah. It's new to them too. But I have been through a lot of this already and run into a lot of the roadblocks because I have enrolled with all these programs, mm-hmm. insurance programs. So you can also do that. What's free though, I mean, if you just, you know, LADCs and solo private practice, that Facebook group that I run, if you just post your question there, if I know the answer, or somebody else in the group knows the answer, they will respond mm-hmm. there. That's free, right? So for a lot of like the general things, you can get your answers there, no problem. So don't book time with me unless it's really like you're really nuanced. I mean, I encourage it because I want to develop those relationships and I really like consulting, but I don't want you to waste money either, right? If it's a question that can get answered in the group, maybe try that first. Then feel free to reach out. But, or if it's time sensitive, right? Like for her, it was like, she couldn't wait any longer. That's a great time mm-hmm. to reach out to me and say, I just can't, you need to talk. Perfect, right? I know how it can be. It was hard for me. I got started on savings. You know, it took me a good 6 months to get online with all the insurance payers. And so for those 6 months, I was still providing services, mm-hmm. but I wasn't getting paid. I never did get paid for those. And I had to write those claims off on taxes. So, yeah, it'll work out because, you know, I didn't pay taxes that year. So they got to have that huge amount. It was like $14,000. Yeah. But, you know, once you get it set up and flowing right, and claims are flowing okay, and your mm-hmm. forms are set up according to 245G, and you're following all the rules and guidelines, it's really encouraging to see those payments come in every week from all the different payers. And, you know, it really is motivating. Money motivates. I'm sorry, it just does. It's just a practicality of life. Mm-hmm. So you can make a really good salary if you really work hard and you are willing to put the time in.
Absolutely. No, that's amazing stuff, man. And I just really feel like even though you've gone through your struggles through this, you're just paving the way for all of us to get on this new career avenue, man. And it's truly a blessing. It really is.
I love that. I've become more aware of that over time, that just how new I am. First, I kind of was at all this, or second, maybe Lindsay might have been first, my old coworker. But I just love this, talking about it, consulting about it. I just think there needs to be more of us, because a lot of these referral sources are looking for private practice clinicians that, instead of the bigger programs, because they'll get clients, they'll assess, that have been to these big programs over and over and over again. And they just keep cycling through the system. I hang on to people a minimum of 6 months until their sub disorder is in partial remission. I hang on to maybe sometimes longer if they have lapses along the way and I'm not convinced they have the skills and the tools to adequately manage. I hang on to them. If they lapse, that's just part of the process. I don't kick them out. I don't discharge them. If they don't show up for a week, I don't kick them out. I don't discharge them. I just keep nudging them to come back. You know, that all changed when I was challenged in grad school. And I have seen some clients. Well, I've had a client once that took off on a meth binge for a month. And I just kept nudging them a couple times a week via text message. Hey, when you're ready to come back, I'm still here. Your chart, I didn't discharge you. Your chart's inactive, but you know, it's just a button to push. And I know that you, you know, are going to, I know you're probably struggling with shame and guilt right now, but we're here for you, right? We're here for you. We're here for you. We just kept, sure enough, in a month, he came back and he was on probation too. So that wasn't good. Ooh. And he proceeded to stay clean for the following 6 months, discharged. It's been a year and a half now. And I just talked to him the other day. He's still clean and sober. So
awesome.
You just don't know, but don't give up so quick. You don't, you have the ability to choose like those thresholds, right? Like, when do I say they need a higher level of care? And when do I decide, you know, when is it appropriate for that? And when is it appropriate to see a pattern of this happening? And I just need to wait. And, you know, instead of recycling him again through the system again, right? So referral sources will, like drug courts in particular, I get a lot of referrals from, probation officers, I get a lot of referrals from those clients that are really difficult to deal with. And for me, they're not so difficult because I love trauma work. It really comes down to more just like being person-centered and individualized and being personable and really convincing them like you got their back.
Yes.
You may not be able to always get the result they want. Like, I'm battling CPS right now with a client. But if they feel that you got their back, they're going to come back if they slip, or they're going to not leave at all and talk about it as they're struggling, which is what I always encourage the most. So think critically about those things,
mm-hmm.
right? I saw that a lot in these big programs, just discharge, so quick to discharge. Client is being defiant.
Yep.
No. You don't need to use that language, right? We would really never say that in mental health. We would look at maybe an oppositional defiant disorder symptom. We would use symptoms, right? Or remember, behaviors in the substance use world are symptoms of the disease. So that's how you should be writing it.
Yeah.
You know, Joe is currently, and I don't have a Joe, so I'm just making that up, but Joe is currently, you know, experiencing, you know, behavioral symptoms as a result of recent use of, and this is what it looks like, or this is how we're addressing it is what you should be saying, right? This is how we're updating the treatment and interventions. This is how I'm trying to meet him where he's at right now. And yeah, abstinence and that process is kind of halted at the moment. So now we're back to dealing with stages of change, trying to motivate him again to return to action stage of change, right? That should be becoming your full-time gig at that moment. And then that's how your documentation should follow that thread, right?
Yep.
Stages of change, I'm telling you, I learned this in grad school. It is not a linear process.
Absolutely.
It is circular, and you can be in several stages at the same time, and it can bounce back and revert, come back. You got to think about it more dynamically. It happens. Shit happens. You can have a client that's, you know, one day from graduation at the 6 month mark, and then they go off on a bender. What does that mean? That should tell you something, you know?
They don't lose that experience.
No. And I tell my clients that all the time, like, because they'll hear that in their own recovery groups, like, well, your clock started over. And I always say, no. Every day you wake up, you're more evolved than the previous day because you've learned more about life, right? There's more context, there's more knowledge. What does sometimes start over is the hedonic set point, the biological systems, right? So if withdrawal might start over, for instance. So now we're going to be dealing with some symptoms of withdrawal for a little while, and we need to really focus on that. So if you have experience or when working in 245G programs for a long time, at least my experience was, as the risk ratings increase, right? So we're talking about dimension 5 mainly, maybe 6 if the environment is antagonistic enough, but 5 mainly, and the substance use gets to the point where there's self-harm happening, the client can't stop and really does need a controlled environment to arrest the use, then you should do that referral, right? You should be mindful and thoughtful about who you're referring to, what program you're referring to. Make sure you get a release to make them communicate with you along the way if the client's going to come back to you.
Yeah.
In private practice, I expect them to come back to me. right? Mm-hmm. So I always have that space available to them. And they usually do. Maybe they won't, but usually they do. And when they have a lapse, there's lots of shame and guilt that happens at that moment.
Absolutely.
So you have to be able to meet them in that shame and guilt and really Brene Brown, right? Them up.
Yes. Let's
just talk about how shame and guilt are really systems that are meant to kind of keep us in alignment with our values, right? And when you violate a value, and moving towards life is like just an inherent value, right? We were born and we live for a reason. So shame and guilt comes, it just comes in sometimes really huge amounts. Then you need to be able to walk in that moment and say, yeah, I hear you. I feel that. I can see what you're saying. You know, I can relate sometimes if mm-hmm. that's appropriate. And then remind them like they're not alone in that process. You're there with them, and they are not starting over completely. They have yes. all the, every day they wake up and they've evolved another day. They have more experience and knowledge, which will help inform the next decision they make. What it should say to you as a clinician is, okay, let's identify what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Where do we need to strengthen refusal skills? Where do we need to strengthen relapse protection skills? Mm-hmm. Notice I use the term relapse protection and not relapse prevention,
mm-hmm.
positive psychology. Okay. So where do we need to strengthen these things? And then of course, document that in the treatment plan. Mm-hmm. How do we update that, right? And then communicate with collaterals, especially if it's probation, like, okay, this is how we're addressing this lapse. And that may happen 20 times while they're with
yep.
you.
Well, and it's so hard too, because you got so many programs. And again, when I say this, I'm not bashing, let's say, AANA, but there's a lot of shame that goes on there sometimes when someone relapses.
Yeah.
And it's more of a, sometimes a hierarchy, like the more like clean time you have, the more higher up on the respect ladder you get. Again, not all AA, but some do that.
And I don't really know if I feel like adequately ready to respond to that, because I did not use AA or NA or those types of groups to recover. Mm-hmm. So I don't push them as much as like maybe I should sometimes when it's appropriate. Mm-hmm. It's not always like I won't ever push a client to do it if I feel like they're not motivated to do it, they're not going to connect in some way, or especially like clients where the primary driver is mental health.
Yes.
Sending them to an AA or NA group is probably not going to help. Maybe it depends on the circumstance. So I might think about, well, why don't we talk about like a dual diagnosis group on, you know, mm-hmm. online or in person if they're in the city. I work with a lot of rural people too. So a lot of times mm-hmm. we have to go the online route. The In the Rooms app is the one I tell all my clients to use, because that has okay. every kind of meeting available around the world that you can imagine, and it's free.
Mm-hmm.
<You know? laughs> And it's kind of dummy proof. It's really easy to use.
Well, from my experience, so like working with clients, like I'm personally not in recovery. So sometimes though, when I work with clients, and this kind of happened to me when I was at Tech at a treatment center too, they would float more towards the staff member who was in recovery. And again, the same goes to counseling too, where I always get the response, well, you don't know what it's like. You don't know how I feel, whatever. But a counselor who has gone through addiction does know.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just tough sometimes.
Listen, I get that a lot from clients too. And I push back on it a lot too, because mm-hmm. I've had some really great experiences with coworkers that didn't have that. Mm-hmm. And they were still fantastic clinicians. So redirecting. What are the common things we can relate on in those moments? Life is hard. It's painful. So maybe thinking about having them identify their emotions, what they're experiencing, and then, okay, I can relate to that emotion. This is how I can relate to that emotion, right? Experience connects to experience that way, if that's the route you want to go.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you just have to let them get it out and talk, you know? And yeah, it may be a little harder to prove yourself over time. But at the end of the day, people want to be heard, they mm-hmm. want to be seen, and they want to be respected despite yes. their disease. So if you can consistently hold those spaces and energies with a client, eventually, once they get to know you, they're going to yeah. care less and less and less that you had that experience or not had that experience. Yes. And probably, I'm just going to take a guess, that you probably have some trauma along the way in your life.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Most of us have. I mean, I don't have to be a fortune teller to know that. So that's an, that is an area you could, if you wanted to go there, mm-hmm. sometimes it's not appropriate. That is an area you could, you know,
well, use. You're right.
Yeah. So maybe I didn't struggle with the disease of addiction, but I struggled with what, right? This trauma. And this has caused me to be, to struggle with this symptom or that symptom, you know, behaviorally in my life. Impulsiveness, spending too much money, mm-hmm. codependency, gambling, sex addiction. I don't know.
Well, no, you're absolutely right. And another thing too, it's just, it always kind of grinds my gears when sometimes people will call like me a normie or use the term normie. Have you ever heard of that before?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And I don't know, like my thing is like exactly what you said. Okay, just because people are not in recovery, or whatever, doesn't mean that they haven't gone through something, let's say, traumatic or some hard life issues. And I just think it's a negative connotation. It's like normie, like you're just normal and you don't have any issues. Well, that's right. Not true. That's not true at all.
Yeah, which is a thinking error, right? So there's mm-hmm. an opportunity. Well, hey guys, today we're going to talk about thinking errors mm-hmm. and absolutes in particular, right? Because mm-hmm. they're almost always false. And you know, this slang term that I'm hearing, normie, and I also want to talk about like how that makes me feel. Because let me tell you, the vast majority of our clients either don't have the ability to, they haven't learned how to label, identify their emotions and process them with other people yet, or they have, but they don't know how to navigate that well, right? Mm-hmm. They haven't had the opportunity to practice it with somebody who's healthy. So that's where I would go. Like every group, every single group that when we do check-ins, first thing that clients have to do is look at the emotion wheel, and they have to pick out three emotions that are positive, three that are negative. And that helps ground them in reality that throughout our day, we're going to have positive and negative emotions. That's normal. It normalizes that. And then we move on to the rest of check-in. But every single time, we'll sit there until they pick those three things that they can identify with. And I might do the same thing if I'm going to reflect back. Like, okay, when you said normie today, this is how this made me feel. And then I'll go through and I'll label and identify the emotions that that caused me to feel. Those are the moments where lots of times they'll sit there and they'll think about it and they'll go, wow, I didn't realize I was really like causing him to feel that way. You know, my words do have power. They do have impact. And I kind of verbally attack, right?
Yeah.
By labeling him something that I don't really know is true. And really, what does that definition mean anyway? So those are the spaces mm-hmm. you would go, right? Let's talk about this, how this makes me feel. And then maybe you could tie it into, I've had my own struggles along the way. And this is, if that is where sometimes it's, you don't want to do that, right? You don't mm-hmm. want to, boundaries. So yeah, always thinking about turning it around. If it's making you feel angst when they say something like that, or making you feel activated in the nervous system, then the first question should be, is this transference or countertransference?
Mm-hmm. Good point.
And then what do I do with that?
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you can navigate it.
Well, and that goes along with always having supervision, or maybe even mm-hmm. seeing a therapist yourself as an addiction counselor, mm-hmm. or as a therapist, you know?
For sure. I have a therapist.
Yeah.
I was very particular in what I wanted, and so I was very selective. But absolutely, I think we should all have a therapist. Absolutely. Honestly, even if we put them on pause for a while every once in a while, stuff's going to come up for us. And having another professional to bounce that stuff off can be really, really helpful. Even when you have a lot of knowledge, like I have the knowledge to figure out like what is really bothering me, but I need to say it to another professional in order to hear it.
Yes,
and I find that true almost always when the session ends. I'm like, he didn't give me any answers, but all my answers were everything I just said, you know, and made in a line and made sense only because he was on the other end of the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Just being in my mind, thinking about it, nothing ever settles. So, you know, yeah, we should all have a therapist on hand for sure.
All about that self-care, man. That's what it is.
Yeah, self-care is going to be critical to being in private practice because it's not just the clients you have on your mind all the time. It's also the business.
Right.
You know, like right now I'm really stressing about claims that are kind of messed up and I'm trying to have them fixed. And anyways, and so that's on my mind too. So how do I take care of myself? Well, first of all, I embed my what I know about myself with how I schedule things. So I don't do mornings. So I schedule things in the afternoons. I don't see clients on Fridays because I don't have to. Yes. Nobody's telling me I have to. Or the weekends. So I chose a 3-day weekend, right? Now I'm busy, I'm doing consulting and stuff like that. So Fridays I end up doing work, but not client-facing work, which is a different kind of energy pull. So Monday through Thursday, groups, individuals, and that works for me. I work late those nights. I get the hours I need in. And then I know Thursday night, that's my Friday. That's motivating.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have 3 days just to process all the energy that I dealt with that week, all that intensity. But and I reset.
Robert, man, again, what you said was so important for everything in life, but especially private practice work. Know yourself and know who you are as a human being. Let's say, okay, I want to make a lot of money. Well, know yourself. If you know you're not good with paperwork or time management or organization yet, that's okay. One, try to get organized and try to work on your time management skills. Mm-hmm. But you know what? Maybe just take some assessments at first. Get those, like we talked earlier, get those paychecks in, get those claims in.
Get the insurance contracts rolling. Yep.
Take a small case, though. See how you do. And if you're doing okay, well, this is easy. Yep. Move on to the next phase, maybe adding more clients.
There's a big opportunity here. I have one referent source in particular that's always looking for LADCs that are willing just to do individuals.
Oh, just individuals. Okay.
Yes, because the clients are resisting groups. And we're supposed to be moving towards more person-centered, meeting mm-hmm. them where they're at, while at the same time matching service levels. So sometimes we can depart from the clinical dimension ratings when we can justify it, right?
Okay.
And when the client absolutely refuses to do anything else but something, you know, that may depart from that. But you want to make sure you're documenting that along the way. So I would document it as something like, this client was referred to me because I could provide individual sessions. They do not want groups for whatever reason. Even though the assessment clearly indicates they should be, probably need those group hours too. Since client is not in that readiness for stage space, we're going to meet individually more frequently during the week. And then we're going to work on stages of change. We're going to work on, I'm going to use MI, motivational interviewing, and I'm going to try to motivate them to be more engaged in a group dynamic, because there's a lot that happens in a group dynamic that you don't get from individuals. And so I was talking about one of my LADCs questioning this the other day. Up until the COVID rules changed, you could only do so many individuals a week, especially on telehealth. Now that has been lifted, those restrictions, permanently. So if you need to meet with a client 5 days a week individually, you could do that and bill for that. You just have to be able to clinically document why it's appropriate. So if you have a client that probably should be in high intensity, right? And you have somebody else already doing the UAs, because I don't UA, that's a different conversation. And they refuse to do groups, they refuse to go inpatient. I'm documenting all that along the way. Then I'll say, okay, well then I'm gonna meet them at that high intensity level by meeting with them for an hour, 5 days a week for the first 90 days. And we're gonna work individually on motivation for change. I'm going to continuously try to get them to engage or be ready to engage in a group dynamic. And we'll do the work we can on an individual level. And I can bill for that. That'd be perfectly fine. It's all about your clinical conceptualization and treatment matching, right? Mm-hmm. What's appropriate. Now, big programs aren't going to do that because they want the group billing.
Yes.
Just to be frank and honest, that's where the money is. When you can bill, 10 people at a time for the same time frame, there's a lot more money in that than meeting individually mm-hmm. for an hour. So this is an area where we can depart from those rules and really meet clients where they're at. And that's a unique opportunity. And there are plenty of clients wanting that are asking for that.
That's great. So I have a question. So I'll say when that counselor refers that client to you, right, and you're just doing one-on-ones, so that original counselor is no longer doing weeklies with them, no longer doing groups, you have full control, right?
Say, reword that again. I'm not sure I understood the question.
So say the original counselor is struggling with this client with groups and whatever, and he refers them to you, right, just for one-on-ones, because again, you're arguing that groups are not appropriate for this client at the moment, and you're just going to do one-on-ones, right?
Okay, sure. So you mean like for another clinician?
Yeah.
If another clinician refers to you, then those services stop with the other clinician. They begin with you. They shouldn't be seeing two different LADCs. I just want to clarify that, right?
Yep.
So yeah, you could do that. If that clinician doesn't want to do individuals 5 days a week instead, or they can't because maybe their program won't allow them to, then if you do a therapeutic transfer to another LADC, you could do that. I would keep the client involved in that process. And sometimes that'll happen. Like clients, an LADC in a big program might decide like the client can't comply with these program requirements. And so let's call Rob because he's private practice and he doesn't have to follow those, our program rules, right?
Yep.
And that might be totally appropriate and that can happen. And then they do a therapeutic transfer and it's not against staff advice or anything like that. And they keep on keeping on. Right.
So then now you have to find a way to communicate to his or her insurance company that that's not appropriate. So do you put that in the individual treatment plan or how do you communicate?
Well, okay. So you do probably a new updated comp assessment. And then there in the bottom of your comp assessment where you write recommendations, you would write all that in there, right? The narrative. Yeah. You'd write, this is what the client was doing. This is what the client wants. It wasn't working over here for these reasons. It is appropriate or not appropriate, right? It's appropriate for us to get the client where they're at this point. They just want to do individuals. They're willing to do intensive, you know, meeting with me 5 days a week for the first 90 days. So we're going to give that a go and see how that goes. And, you know, really at the end of the day with an insurance company is going to, two things they're going to look at. They're going to look at, are they meeting diagnostic criteria, right? So when was the last date of use? Is it still really causing problems in their life? Do they meet criteria? And then they look at the chart, they will do that. They'll pull a chart from time to time. They're going to look for that explanation. Why did this client go from this provider to that provider? I have a client from a long time ago that was with me for the first 60 days. And then he started triangulating and then he wanted to end services with me and go do EMDR. But because I had the mental health background, I knew what was happening. I knew that this was a personality disorder that I think I was seeing and the triangulation was part of the symptoms, right? So then it was my responsibility to get a release, call the EMDR therapist and say, hey, I'm okay with him doing EMDR, but I'm not okay with him stopping outpatient sub services because I know enough about EMDR to know that he's going to be more activated and he's going to need those supports. So just stopping sub services, unless you as the mental health therapist have the training and feel competent in treating both at the same time. In that case, I'll do a complete therapeutic transfer, but I've documented that I've talked to you about that. It's no longer my responsibility, right? So you got to be mindful of those things and document them along the way. Insurance companies are never going to, it's always reactive, right? So they're going to come in every once in a while and say, hey, I want Joe's chart from these states. Blue Cross Blue Shield might. You give them the entire chart. They audit it. They come back with what they think you need to change. And then they move on. And you might not hear from them again for another year. Right. But you might hear from health partners who hasn't audited you yet. So depending upon how many insurance companies here. So you want your document, the more, I always say like more documentation, the less likely you're to get a clawback. But at the same time, you also want to protect the client too. So that's really whatever works for you, I guess. Follow the golden thread. In mental health, there's this rule like, the assessment needs to follow the treatment plan. The treatment plan needs to follow the progress notes, and they all need to like make sense with each other.
Yeah.
Right. So when you're working on things in individual, you need to be working on things that are in the treatment plan. That's true for us too. So don't be working on things that are not in the treatment plan is what I'm trying to say. Because if you get audited, that's one reason they could say, you're not even doing what you said you were going to do. We're going to claw back these claims. And they will.
Yeah, that brings up a really another interesting point too. Like earlier you said, okay, you know, there's a reason why there's a 6,000 hour requirement.
Yes.
So we know what we're doing. Because do you feel like we're in the front lines right now where we need to set a good example? Because if we start this process right now, which we're doing, and we keep screwing up, will the state or insurance companies be like, hey, this is a bad idea. We're not going to allow this anymore. Is that a possibility? Or I don't know.
It's really hard to change law once it's done, right? Law is law. So it would require legislative action. Mm-hmm. But yes, we're in the infancy of this new law. And I think I was talking to you a little bit about this the other day. Like, we need an advocacy group, like NADAC or something specific to LADCs in Minnesota and private practice, because there are things like we can't do that. I personally feel like we should be able to do, like hire a peer recovery support person and bill for that. We can't do that because we're not a 245G program the way the rule is written. And then there's that you can't affiliate with other providers providing substance use services, right? Mm-hmm. So it would be nice if we had a group that represented us that could go advocate for us and lobby for us at the state legislators to kind of change that language so we have more available to us, right? So yes, we're on the front lines. We're in the infancy. We're the first to go. We need to be mindful of that and representing our group in a professional way. Absolutely. Yes. And I suppose, if it absolutely was a complete disaster, there could be legislation to nix the rule, but it probably wouldn't happen. It would probably be more like restrictions would get more detailed and tighter instead to kind of curb whatever the behaviors are they were seeing. It's once you start something like this, it's kind of hard to put the cat back in the cage, you know? So I wouldn't worry too much about that. What I would just be more focused on is how can I provide services that align with who I am, my spirit. So my business is called Soul Savvy because I believe in like more new age concepts. And I do believe in some religious energies too, and Christianity in particular I tap into, but it's more about like spirituality and the soul. When I look through that lens, I also see the mental health lens, and I also see the biological lens, and they all kind of, it's just different language, but it all is saying the same thing for me, you know? So that's how I kind of market myself. Like, okay, well, I'm using the language of the field, right? I'm providing individualized, person-centered substance use disorder treatment for a certain length of time for these reasons. And all of that aligns with my values and the business values too. Soul Savvy's values. Hanging on to people as long as I need to hang on with them. Hang on to them. Meeting them where they're at. Yes. Especially when they're struggling the most. Not using positive psychology. Not condemning them. Not putting them down. Not using some of the old LADC tactics of shaming or anything like that. Right? Making them feel like they have somebody they can come to and talk to. Yes. All that aligns with all my spiritual principles and values also. So who are you is the first question. I hired a marketer who was in the mental health field the first month who set up my social media accounts. She does websites too, but I haven't had her done that yet. And then she created the marketing to speak to those things, right? In the right language. But who are you? What
do you stand for?
What do you stand for? And how does that align with your business values and your values? And then how does that align with the services you're providing? Yeah. Make sure all those things are in alignment, right? Because I'm very clear with my referral sources. This is my process and this is why. And then they make the decision. This client would be good for them. This client wouldn't be good for them, instead of me just making it during assessment and, you know, always referring people to other people because they don't match what I do.
Right.
So think about that. Who am I? How do I show up for clients? Then how can I put that in my marketing? How can I put that in the clinical language of the services that I'm able to bill and provide? Super important. Yeah.
It's beautiful stuff, man. It is.
It takes some thinking. Danielle Cottier, I think, was the marketer I hired. She's on Facebook. Okay. She's a mental health clinician. She was reasonable. She worked with me from what I could afford. She did a fantastic job. You know, she knows how to ask. She knows how to ask the questions to get you to kind of come up with the answers.
Okay.
So I just hired her for a month, and she did all that work, and it was helpful at first when I wasn't getting any referrals.
What's her name again?
Danielle Cottier, I think. We could put the link up later. I'll send it to you afterwards. Sure. Yeah.
Perfect.
You know, she negotiated how much I could pay, and I haven't used her since, because then after that I just blew up with referrals.
But so she sets up like the website, how clients can build, and okay.
She'll set up your social media accounts for your business. She'll create marketing material for you for social media.
Yes,
she'll She'll manage your social media too if you want her to.
Okay.
She'll create a whole marketing plan. Yeah.
I like it already. All right.
Yeah. So if you're worried about that, nobody knows who I am. It's just starting. Like, she can handle all that if you can come up with a deal with her, or you can do it yourself. I just haven't found the need to do any more advertising after the first month, because once the right people who are in the field doing assessments knew what I was doing and the kind of clients I was taking, they're always emailing me. Do you have any openings?
Well, it's funny. I remember like one of our early conversations, I'm like, hey man, you know, I can help promote you or whatever. And you're like, no, I had too many clients.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm thinking in my head, I'm like, God, I wish I had that problem someday.
You could very easily. It just, once people find out like that you're in private practice and you're doing this LADC work and you're willing to meet clients really truly meet clients where they're at, then there are plenty of referrals that'll come your way. And that also brings up, like, I better just quick say something about harm reduction. No, if you're only going to be absent based, you need to be clear about that.
Yes.
You know, do not take clients on that do not want that. That does not match their readiness for change, right?
Yep.
If you want to work with harm reduction, then know that too. Be clear about that. And be good about documenting along the way, because that's going to be even more important.
I think 245G programs have the worst problem with that, because, again, they're not honest with themselves. Again, I'm not going to out any treatment centers right now, but they'll say, like, our original idea is we're abstinence-based. But then they some harm reduction slide or whatever, and it's just confusing for the clients, the staff, et cetera. So I hear you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I am seeing more and more of them trying to integrate more acceptance of, you know, like medication-assisted treatment therapies and things like that they're allowing in their inpatient facilities. It's hit or miss. To be fair, like, if you're going to take on clients that are on medication assisted therapies, then there's more stuff you have to have at the program, right? There are more rules to follow, which costs more money. But there are some programs out there that are doing a fantastic job of this. I'll take harm reduction, I'll take abstinence. I have a mix of the both in my group, my substance use group. And then my treatment plans reflect that, right? Whether it's harm reduction or it's abstinence based. And everybody's going to be different.
You separate those two groups, or will you have some abstinence-based clients? Okay. That's another thing. That's another thing. I've been a part of some programs. Again, not outing any programs, but they'll have, like, let's say their main thing's harm reduction, but they'll literally have a handful of clients who are abstinence-based. And when I was in those groups, I'm like, I don't know about this. I mean, I respect both, but how are the clients going to kind of react off of each other when they don't have, you know what I mean, a similar goal? I don't know.
Well, because I have a co-occurring master's degree, it's really a co-occurring substance use disorder group, but I don't bill that way. I bill only as a substance use group, because I'm not fully licensed as a mental health provider yet, right? I only have the degree, and then I have mental health supervision. But I'm still providing a co-occurring group because I'm focused on both substance use and mental health. So during informed consent and during, my process is I'll meet with a client for like 15 to 20 minutes first before I do anything, before I even say I'll consider them or take them. And I will explain to them how I do services And I will also explain to them, it's a co-occurring subgroup and online, and some people are on harm reduction measures, some people are on abstinence-based, some people are on medication-assisted treatment, and then I'll listen to their concerns about that. Some will have issues with it and some won't. And if it's something that you just isn't going to work, then you refer out. I do that right up front. So I'm not doing an assessment and then having to refer out. If it's a harm reduction client and they're using like all the time, and it's really like they're presenting like they're really high all the time and everything like that, because that can be so triggering in group, I won't put them in group right away. I'll work with them individually first for a while.
Good.
And try to get them to the point where they're not using before group, depending on the substance, and so not that, presenting that way.
So again, to all my listeners, that would be an example of, okay, top assessment summary, and at the bottom saying, hey, this client appears with this, this, and this symptom. I recommend that he does one-on-ones for a while. Let's say, what we say, 2 weeks, a month, I don't know, until they're ready to transition to groups.
Yeah, I mean, if they're using like every day, I'm going to, and they've refused at that point, first I'm going to make sure that they don't want inpatient and they're refusing it. Mm-hmm. But then I'll meet with them 5 days a week until we can start to reduce the amount and frequency of the use, right, and move towards more stability instead of triggering the group constantly. The group's going to get triggered because people are going to lapse and they're going to have to come in the group, talk about those things. But that's different than having somebody constantly presenting like they're under the influence the whole 3 hours every time, you know. So you have to be mindful of those things if you're going to navigate that kind of a group. So I would suggest maybe only if you're dually licensed or have the mental health background, that might be wise. Otherwise, maybe stick to just abstinence-based or clients that are stabilized well on medication-assisted therapies, right?
Yep.
I have a year ago, I had a pregnant mother who was on Sublocade, and really stable on that. That was fine. She didn't present high, you know, on the in group, and that was appropriate. And I talk about those things openly in group, and we talk about those things as a group. What is the difference between medication assisted therapies and abstinence based, and why are both just as valid of a path for recovery? And why can you still be in recovery if you're on a medication assisted therapy, right? So sometimes you have to do a little work unwinding some of the language that's used in non-professional groups to really get them to understand your clinical thinking and why you do things the way they do. But usually clients understand once you talk about it with them, and they can relate in some way. They get it. Not a one size fits all thing. But if you absolutely are not competent in dealing with that kind of complexity, maybe stick to abstinence based, but just know that's going to limit your referrals.
And people, again, know yourself, know who you are, okay? And know your credentials, scope of practice. I can't tell you how many times I've seen it and I've heard it where counselors or even therapists will do too much or take a client who's very, you know, let's just say going through a lot of traumatic stuff or has had a lot of traumatic issues, and they take them on when they know they don't have the experience to handle them. So many times, and it's disastrous.
Yep, absolutely. So, and as somebody who has 6,000 hours, you're expected to know that. The board would expect you to know that. You know, saying I didn't know that is not going to fly. If there's a complaint, it's not going to work well for you. So yeah, what you're competent in, what you're comfortable dealing with, and make that clear to your referral sources so they're not just wasting your time, they're not wasting their time. And be willing to be open to consultation. Like some of my referral sources, they know, like if they're unsure, they think I might be, they know they can call me up and say, this is a scenario. They'll use generic, you know, they won't identify anybody in particular, but they'll say, this is the scenario. What do you think? Is this somebody you can work with? And I'm like, okay, that makes sense. Or no, but hey, I know another LADC in private practice. Again, another reason for me to be in the know. Let me reach out to them and see if they have any openings, if they'd be willing to work with us. We have to network because we're so new and we're so small. We have to really support each other in that way.
And also, you know, licensed mental health providers are not off the hook. this could even be even your PhD, PsyD, you could still not have experience in a certain population. Then you'd have to make the mature decision to refer.
Yeah.
Throw the ego out the door.
Yeah. In the Twin Cities, there's a lot more options, and with telehealth now, right, for more specialized care. When I was in rural Minnesota and before COVID, like, there wasn't a lot of specialties. So you kind of had to take whatever client you got, right? But it's different here. There are options. So yeah, know yourself, know what you're comfortable working with, where your spirit is, what you're competent in, and stay within those lanes. You'll be a lot happier and have a lot less stress and be a lot less worried about a potential board complaint. Or just the frustration of not knowing where to go with the client, right?
Yep.
And be willing to seek out consultation. If you think you know, you're not sure, and you're really struggling, and there's no change happening, and then consult with others in the group, or someone like me, or some maybe a professor you respect that is in the field. They're invaluable. Sometimes we forget about them because we graduate and time happens, but oftentimes they're still there. They still love to talk about this stuff.
You know, and the dangerous thing, especially when you get to the master's clinician level and you're in LPCC, you can do a lot of stuff legally, right? And the main topic I'm getting at is just EMDR. We're going to just go throw out EMDR. That's the fad now, right? And what I found out recently is, like, if you're a master level licensed clinician, you could do like something like EMDR without the training. I highly, highly advise not to do that, people.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
So dangerous.
There's so many schools of thought on this kind of thing. So, yes, if you're not trained and licensed in EMDR, you should not be doing it, period. It's not best practices. You open yourself up to liability. And probably you're dealing with trauma, right? Which is complex. So it's always better to refer out if that's the route you're going to go. I've sent people to EMDR therapists while I was a therapist, put them in active, sent them to EMDR for a while, came back and resumed working with them because we were able to identify a target. So something from their past that was the root cause of causing some of the triggers and trauma to reemerge, right? So yes, absolutely refer out if you're dealing with mental health. Don't advertise or say you do something and you're not certified in it. You can't show. This ADHD is a good example. You can go to an MD and all they're going to do is look at the DSM, ask you questions. Do you have these symptoms? You do? Okay. Then you meet criteria. Here's a stimulant, right? Doesn't mean that it's going to necessarily be an accurate assessment, because what if that client just read up on the DSM-5 and they knew to say yes, right? So in that case, then you want to send them to a PhD level or a PsyD level ADHD assessor. There's one that can be done. I had it done a long time ago where it takes all day. It's an all-day assessment. They're testing functioning. They're using the MMPI. There's so much information they're getting. Like, you can't really fake it. So you know the diagnosis is accurate. And if you're dealing with somebody who says they have ADHD and they have a stimulant use disorder and they really want to go get diagnosed with this, then you got to think about those things. You know, can you get them in and to do that? So you really know for sure. Don't do it if you're not.
Oh man,
knowledgeable in your scope of practice.
What's that website that therapists go on to market? Is it like psychology.com or something?
Psychologytoday.com is really popular.
They're horrible though when it comes to the specialties. I mean, God forbid, God bless you if you were specialized in 20, 30 different types of therapies. God bless you, man. But I don't know many people that can cognitively do that. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. So one of the things I noticed about that right away was, when I was looking for a therapist, if I saw that their list of their approaches was a mile long, I said no, because that told me they probably weren't specialized in any one particular thing, especially if they didn't write about it, and that they were just kind of pulling elements from different modalities and they only had a base level of knowledge probably. And that wasn't good enough for what I needed. So Now the ones that just had a limited, like I'll say, these are my limited areas I function in or I'm competent in, then yeah, those are the ones I really took seriously. So yeah, okay, a mental health therapist, technically, you know, if it's a mental health code in the DSM-5, they're technically licensed to be able to address those things, but it doesn't mean that they're competent enough to, and you could be liable.
Yeah.
LADCs kind of have it easier because, I mean, substance use is substance use. Really, we're only thinking about, are we going to do abstinence-based? Or are we going to do harm reduction? Or are we going to do medication-assisted treatment? Work with clients that are on that. We're not going to provide that, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And what does that look like? We're only limited to that substance use section in the DSM-5. Mm-hmm. So absolutely, got to think about all those things.
True.
It's a good question.
Well, Robert, man, I want to say, man, it's been a true pleasure. I know tons of people are going to get a great benefit from this. I know I did. I really did, man.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. I hope so. I really hope more people connect in the Facebook group and we keep the conversation going. They reach out to me if they need it. And
Facebook Live, we should do more Facebook Lives, man.
Yeah, for sure. I did that last one last week, yep. I think, for the first time. That was interesting, fun. But you're going to run up against nuances, and other people that have gone before you sometimes is the best resource, right?
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully this group of people can become big enough where we can have our own, you know, group, advocacy group.
Yes.
Where we can advocate for maybe some higher rates for those of us that have co-occurring degrees. And be able to hire and bill for a peer recovery support person to work with us in our caseload. I think those are legit like things that wouldn't necessarily take away from the spirit of the law, you know, just needs to be altered a little bit in order to provide better services.
It's funny you say that. Like, so when I was an intern, whenever I had this supervisor, I mean, she's nice and everything, but I was trying to make the argument for individuals like us who were going for the co-occurring, how, like, I just feel like sometimes companies don't care about the masters. They'll pay just for the LADC. So my argument is, well, you know, I think we should be compensated a little bit more than that because we're master level clinicians. So we have the mental health. And the supervisor is like, okay, I understand that, but you can't do anything more than an LADC. And it rubbed me the wrong way a little bit because, like, well, to you maybe, but I think we do, and I think we can. You know, so they're, you know, both ways.
Yeah. I mean, if you're not licensed yet in mental health, you know, that's legit. Like, you shouldn't be doing any mental health interventions, right? Unless you're interning or you're post grad and you're under supervision for mental health. But once you have that mental health education, like the way you conceptualize things in your mind is always going to be integrated versus just, you know, the bachelor level LADC substance use education. Now you have the mental health education too. You're not going to be able to tell your brain, okay, only look through it through the lens of, you know, substance use education. It's just not going to work because the brain is now integrated with that additional information. So really what they're probably saying is you can't provide mental health interventions. You definitely need to only document, you know, things that are within the purview of an LADC and stay away from those mental health interventions. But okay, even things like how I look at the stages of change, even as an LADC only, because I have that additional master's education on that higher level of thinking of stages of change, is going to influence what I do as an LADC and influence like how I'm thinking about clients' readiness and where the services need to meet them, and can be completely different than where I would have been before I had the mental health piece. Mental health piece is super important if you really want to treat more complexity.
Now, the difficulty is getting insurance companies to see that awareness that you just like mentioned, like, okay, well then what is that equivalent to as a higher rate? Because what you said is 100% true.
Yeah, so once you're licensed in both worlds, then you have every right to argue with the insurance company, and there's a process, you know. Yeah. You can do it so many times a year, ask for a higher rate, and then make your argument. Or you can hire a third party to do it. So, for instance, the billing company I hired to do my billing also does the contract stuff, right? So they did a lot of my PMAP contracts, and they're the ones then that could write the argument for you. They know more, right? Because they've been doing this over and over again. And so every year when the contract is coming due, I say to them, go back to the insurance company and make an argument that I deserve a higher rate because I'm licensed in both worlds, right? That's what I would do. Or I'm a master's level clinician, LADC, with a co-occurring degree, and that should earn me a higher rate. Yeah. Versus just letting them renew the contract and nobody ever says anything. Then good luck.
That's true. Say something. Yep.
Yep. Be proactive on that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, cool, man. Before we end things for my listeners, if they want to get a hold of you, what are some additional ways they can do that through emails, phone numbers, whatever you.
Yeah. Well, Facebook group is probably the easiest way.
Okay.
Just posting in there, I'll see it. But email's okay too. That's RA Mendoza@soulsavvy.biz. Not .com, not .net, but .biz.
B-I-S?
B-I-Z is in zebra.
Oh, B-I-Z, okay.
I have to clarify that because nobody ever hears that part, and they get frustrated when they keep trying to send .com. Yeah. Not going to work.
Yep. And I will add that all in the show notes as well to all my listeners. So,
okay.
All right, man. True pleasure. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for your time. Okay, bye.
I just want to say it was a true pleasure working with Robert. It's just all the different aspects we all learned together when it comes to developing a private practice, and not only that, but just what it means to be a licensed alcoholic drunk counselor as well as a therapist, and just the barriers and struggles that we have to go through every day to just make a meaning out of our work and influence in our clients' lives. It was truly amazing, and I just want to thank my BHI listeners as well for everyone's support in all of this, and I just want to inform everyone that the content of this episode was not meant to be taken as therapeutic advice. If you do feel yourself dealing with any type of mental health or addiction issues, please seek the care of a licensed therapist or a licensed medical doctor. All right, thank you and have a good day. Bye.